The next case, Devon Jackson et al. Versus Suzuki, has been submitted on the briefs. The final case on calendar for argument today is United States versus Burton.
Good morning, counsel.
Good morning, Your Honors. Sorry, Your Honors, you can wait for Mr. Coleman.
Derek Coleman for appellant.
Johnny Kim on behalf of appellant, defendant appellant Jeremy Burton.
All right, so you all are splitting time.
Yes, Your Honor. If we may reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, right. And then of the 10 minutes of the opening, I'll take 7 and reserve 3 for Mr. Coleman, if necessary.
Wait. Sorry. Stop the clock. So I thought the time was going to be 10 minutes for you and 5 minutes for rebuttal. Is that correct?
I apologize, Madam Clerk. We weren't communicating clearly what we wanted. What we wanted was to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, which I will take, and then of the 10-minute opening, Mr. Coleman get a small portion of that, to the extent that it's necessary. He may not be needed.
Okay, well, so we have 10 minutes on the clock. That's for you.
That's for me. Okay, Your Honor.
All right, so that's what my understanding was. You were going to do the argument, and he was going to do the rebuttal. So let's go with that.
Let's go with that, Your Honor. Your Honor, so we are here. My name is Johnny Kim, and we're here on behalf of Jeremy Burton on his appeal of the district court's denial of his motion to dismiss, which motion was based on the so-called intramilitary immunity provision under the False Claims Act, which is at 31 U.S.C. section 3730E1. And this provision basically provides that no court shall have jurisdiction over a quitan claim brought under the FCA by one member of the armed forces against another member of the armed forces.
Counsel, the difficulty with your argument is the operative word is military. And so how are you putting Mr. Burton into the military? He was a civilian employee, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
And so that, by definition, is not a part of the military, correct?
Well, so according to the district court's ruling, for the purposes of the intramilitary immunity provision of the FCA, he doesn't call Mr. Burton.
Tell us why that was wrong.
Well, Your Honor, so the whole purpose, let me restate this. Immunity from intramilitary claims, Your Honor, the whole purpose of that is to make sure that in that instance, when you have a claim that arises, a claim for injuries that arises out of an incident, out of conduct incident to service.
Military service,
yes, mm-hmm. Your Honor. That necessarily implicates, that would allow the judiciary to, delve into sensitive military matter.
Correct. So, but the difficulty I'm having with your argument is that Mr. Burton was not a member of the military.
But, Your Honor, he was a member of the military, not in the enlisted sense, but his role was really absolutely crucial. He was a high-ranking civilian member of the military, Your Honor.
We have many civilian members of the federal government who perform very sensitive matters. Their contributions are appreciated and very valuable, but that does not make them members of the military. What case are you relying upon to support the proposition that a civilian employee who performs services that are helpful to the military mission become members of the military? What's your strongest case?
Well, I will respond to Your Honor in this way. I think what our position is to clarify is that notwithstanding the fact that Mr. Burton is a civilian employee, he should have the benefit of or should be able to invoke the intramilitary immunity provisions because.
But tell me what case you're relying upon to say you should be able to invoke that. So, what's your strongest case that would make Mr. Burton be considered a member of the military?
I don't have a case that would, a strong case that would have him become a member of the military.
You're asking us to decide this as a matter of first impression.
Not necessarily, Your Honor. Not under the Fairness Doctrine. What we're asking the court to do is dismiss Mr. Burton under the Ninth Circuit's extension of the Fairness Doctrine. So the immunity
but
from
the Fairness Doctrine also applies to members of the military.
Correct, Your Honor. I understand that.
So you're asking us to extend Fairness beyond the military to civilian employees who are affiliated with the military. Is that what you're asking?
If Your Honor's position is that civilian...
I don't have a position. I'm just asking you the question of what you're asking us to decide.
So what we're asking the court to decide is that as a civilian employee, notwithstanding his civilian status, by virtue of his role, claims that are brought against him will necessarily give rise to the potential judicial intrusion into to sensitive military affairs, which include disciplinary processes. And it just so happens, Your Honor, in this particular instance, the universe of established facts is the plaintiff's complaint. And in the complaint, Your Honor, they actually allegations concerning a disciplinary proceeding that they instituted against Mr. Burton based on those claims that they've alleged in the complaint, Your Honor. So this case actually is the perfect example of or would benefit and from the purposes of these intramilitary immunity claims, Your Honor.
Mr. Kamir, I have a different question which is not merits-based, but do we have jurisdiction to hear this case? Why should the collateral order doctrine apply for this particular issue to give us jurisdiction to hear this in the first place?
Is it a denial of a claim, Your Honor, of intramilitary immunity to intramilitary suits is an immunity to the suit. So if you allow a suit to go forward in the face of a denial of a claim of immunity of suit, then that immunity will be forever lost and won't be appealable. So that's the general basis, Your Honor.
Okay.
But when you apply the collateral order doctrine to the facts of this case, Your Honor, we establish the jurisdiction. I don't know if Your Honor wants me to go over that.
Yeah, I mean, I think you need to because I think you have a jurisdictional problem in my view, which is that you're relying on Ferris and Lutz, but those are different cases. You know, those involved actual suits between members of the military for different sorts of claims, not under the False Claims Act. So I think here too, it seems as if you would be asking us to expand the collateral order doctrine into a new category of claim for us to review immediately, because those other cases don't align naturally with this. And if you disagree, tell me why.
Well, is the court's position that only an enlisted member of the military could claim intramilitary or immunity to intramilitary claims?
So well, Ferris, the Supreme Court held that members of the armed services can't sue the government for injuries arising out of the course of military service.
Correct.
Right? Lutz extended that to Bivens and common law tort actions, but again, it involved actual members of the military. And here we have a False Claims Act claim, right? So one that neither Ferris nor Lutz addressed. And you're asking us to extend the collateral order doctrine into a False Claims Act claim involving a non-military service member. So do you see what I'm, you know, but even setting aside the military service aspect of it, wouldn't that be an expansion of the collateral order doctrine yet again?
Under the way Your Honor is describing it, I guess it would, Your Honor, but
And hasn't the Supreme Court really admonished or expressly guided courts to be very mindful of not extending the collateral? You know, it's a very narrow exception to the review for final orders and decisions. So why, I guess the question is, why should it be expanded here? What are the substantial interests that would warrant expansion here?
Because a denial of intramilitary immunity is really a denial of immunity to suit or claim of immunity to suit, Your Honor. And if you apply, like I said, if you apply the facts of this case to the elements of the collateral order doctrine, I believe we meet them. The disputed issue was conclusively established, which was whether or not Mr. Burton was a member of the armed forces within the meaning of the FCA. it resolved.
Request, counsel, did you request that this issue be certified for an immediate appeal?
We did not, Your Honor.
Why not?
Ignorance one, Your Honor, maybe, but also our research showed that we could appeal to the court directly, and then the court would issue a, you know.
Well, I mean, the reason why, as my colleague pointed out, I think the Supreme Court has really limited the scope of the collateral order exception. One reason is that Congress, through its rulemaking abilities, has channeled interlocutory appeals through a process, and right. That process is for litigants to seek certification of interlocutory orders for immediate appeal, but you did not avail yourself of that process, right?
I guess we relied on the substance of the fact that we were denied a claim of immunity to suit. If you're claiming immunity to suit based on immunity to interim military claims, that's a type of claim that's effectively unreviewable after final judgment, Your Honor. So that's why we've as a general matter, that's pretty well settled that those types of cases are entitled to be immediately appealed, if I'm not mistaken. So that's why we're really relying on that basis. Unless the court is saying that unless you're an active enlisted member of the military, you can't have a denial of a claim to intramilitary claim. I can't have a denial of intramilitary immunity because you're not an enlisted member of the Army. Is that why?
No, I think it's whether or not your client is a member of the armed services. We wouldn't have jurisdiction to entertain this issue on appeal because either we disagree with you, it's not an immunity, or for another reason. But in the False Claims Act context, I haven't come across a case that it would allow an immediate appeal on the denial of a defense under 3730E1.
Or the appeal is of the order, Your Honor, but the affirmative relief we're really seeking is it's based on a new argument that we're raising for the first time under an extent the Ferris Doctrine as extended. In the
we have discretion not to address forfeited arguments.
Right? Understood, Your Honor. But as set forth in the brief, we never were given an opportunity to raise this argument in the trial court below. If I may, the court originally granted our motion, then dismissed. Then while we were dismissed with prejudice, there was further briefing on that issue, which involved the question of what is a member of the armed forces. And after that, we were just brought into the case summarily. So in other words, other parties got to additionally brief the issue of what is and what is not a member of the armed forces, and we did not. Notwithstanding that, our client was brought back into the action.
All right. Thank you, counsel. We'll hear from the government.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. This is Connor Karen for private relators, not the government. Mary Jane Brents, David Myung, and Lucky Nguyen. I want to address jurisdiction first because I think Your Honors are correct that the challenged order fails both the first and third elements of Cohen collateral order appealability. First, I'd like to point out a contradiction between appellant's prayer for relief and the conclusiveness element of Cohen collateral order appealability. Jeremy Burton himself is asking for the ability to further litigate the membership question in the district court. And as a threshold condition for appealability, the challenged order needs to conclusively determine the disputed question. So I think this panel can find a lack of appellate jurisdiction on that basis alone. Secondly,
Before you go on, why wasn't it conclusively decided by the district court that Mr. Burton is not a member of the military?
Yes, Your Honor, because the question on conclusiveness is whether there are avenues for Mr. Burton to raise the issue before the district court before final judgment. I'd like to point out that our office filed two superseding complaints, a third amended complaint and a fourth amended complaint, both naming Jeremy Burton, and he had the opportunity to raise the particular factual jurisdictional attack that he proposes on this appeal, but chose not to. So I think that alone, under the Agent Orange case cited by Lutz, defeats conclusiveness for the purposes of the collateral order doctrine under Cohen. I'd also like to address the comparison that my friend raised between the Ferris Doctrine and the False Claims Act member of the Armed Forces Bar. This is not a Ferris case, and the interests underlying Ferris are not the same as underlying 3730E1. As the Supreme Court in United States versus Stanley noted, the interest underlying Ferris is an interest against protecting against congressionally uninvited intrusions into intramilitary affairs. That wasn't the case in the context of the Federal Tort Claims Act, which was the context Ferris was decided. There was no indication that Congress intended to have the judiciary intrude into intramilitary matters under the Federal Tort Claims Act. The same is not true of the False Claims Act. As we know, Congress has explicit plenary authority to regulate the military through legislation, and the False Claims Act is Congress's attempt at regulating the military through legislation. He might argue that 3730E1 reflects a similar interest in refraining from any judicial intrusion into intramilitary affairs, but I think the structure and text of 3730E1 proves that it's not an immunity from suit, but is rather a relator qualification bar. 3730E1 doesn't bar all suits against members of the armed forces for injury to the Treasury. It bars it only when the relator is a member of the armed forces. The exact same litigation is contemplated where the civilian or where the relator is a civilian or whether the Attorney General brings the claim, proving that Congress explicitly contemplated False Claims Act litigation in the intramilitary context where the relator is not a member of the armed forces. And that's the reason that prong three of Cohen is not met here. The effective unreviewability prong of Cohen asks whether the interests embodied by a particular defense would be destroyed if trial or litigation is allowed to happen at all. That's Will versus Halleck. And the fact that Congress expressly contemplated this litigation taking place, where the relator is a civilian or whether the Attorney General brings the claim, shows that Congress specifically contemplated and authorized False Claims Act claims in the intramilitary context, meaning that the process itself can't be the harm that 3730E1 sought to protect against, as was the case in Ferris.
Can I ask a question about your textual argument? Is it your view that a civilian relator could file a suit alleging fraud by a member of the military?
Yes.
In other words, so it's only an exception if there's military versus military, not otherwise.
That's exactly right, Brian. And the text of 3730E1 reflects that. It only prohibits or only divests the court of jurisdiction over claims brought under subdivision B of 3730 by a present or former member of the armed forces. It doesn't exclude similar claims or identical claims brought by civilian relators or the Attorney General. And for that reason, the process can't be said to be the harm in the same way in the False Claims Act context as would be said to be the case in the Ferris context. And the Supreme Court's decision in Geo Group versus Menocal reinforces this point. That case set forth a taxonomy of potential defenses that can be categorized as either merits defenses or immunities from suit being the operative phraseology there. But it also pointed out a third category of orders, which I think this case actually falls into. In footnote one of Geo Group versus Menocal, the court contemplated a category of orders that are merits independent, but nonetheless fail to qualify as immunities from suit because they fail to embody a quote unquote weighty public objective in the Will versus Halleck sense. And a weighty public objective in the Will versus Halleck sense is one that is destroyed if trial takes place at all. So I think this case, in terms of appealability, or this type of order, 3730E1 denials, fall in that third category contemplated by footnote one of Geo Group versus Menocal, and thus are non-appealable under Cohen's third prong on that basis. So for those reasons, I don't think this panel needs to reach the merits of this appeal at all. I think it lacks appellate jurisdiction for failures on elements one and three of Cohen.
Counsel, why isn't this defense an immunity? 3730E1 states very clearly no court shall have jurisdiction over this action involving the relevant categories of people bringing an FCA claim.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm going to address the jurisdictional part first. The mere fact that a defense may be jurisdictional doesn't mean that it's effectively unreviewable on final judgment in the Will versus Halleck sense. That's United States versus Layton, and it's also in the Lutz versus Secretary of the Air Force, and the Supreme Court also decided a similar principle in Van Kallenberg versus Viard in the personal jurisdiction context. In fact, jurisdictional denials are the classic type of denials that are reviewed after final judgment. And if we were to find that the mere fact that a defense is jurisdictional in nature gives rise to an immediate appeal, that would effectively swallow the final judgment rule and make every 12B1 denial immediately.
But we do that in the area of qualified immunity. Why isn't this similar to that?
Thank you, Your Honor. The reason this is not similar to qualified immunity is because qualified immunity is a true immunity from suit over an entire subject matter of cases, where government actors are entitled to total immunity over all cases where the law is not clearly established. By contrast, 3730E1 isn't an immunity that's borne by members of the armed forces over all categories in a particular subject matter of lawsuit. It's only where a particular type of relator brings the case that the case is barred by subject matter jurisdiction. So in that regard, qualified immunity is a true immunity from suit in the GEO group versus Menocal sense, whereas 3730E1 is not.
Why wouldn't it be an immunity if the statute says the case can't be brought?
Because it can be brought by certain people is the answer. It's not that it can't be brought at all. It can't be brought by a member of the armed forces, but it can be brought for example, a Parsons employee or the attorney general. That means it's not a true immunity from suit that the defendant enjoys, but it's a bar on a relator qualification for a False Claims Act lawsuit. And there's a case in the Tenth Circuit that came down late last year that employs substantially identical reasoning that I'm asking this panel to employ in this case, and it's Fiorice versus Colorado Technical University. The reason I think this case is so important is because it decided the appealability question in the context of another 3730E relator qualification bar, the public disclosure bar. That case found that since other relators can bring a similar claim, namely ones that have not based their False Claims Act claim on publicly disclosed information, a denial of 3730E4, the public disclosure bar, is not immediately appealable under the Cohen collateral order test. And the Fiorice court went a step further and noted that even if the public disclosure bar were jurisdictional, like 3730E1 is, it still would not give rise to immediate appealability because the jurisdictional nature of the defense is not the hallmark of immediate reviewability under Cohen. So I think the holding of Fiorice could almost be copied and pasted into an order in this case with, you know, some adjustments for the differences between 3730E1 and 3730E4. Because some relators who are not members of the armed forces can bring identical claims against the same defendant, and Congress specifically contemplated and authorized it, that means it's not an immunity from suit in the GEO group versus Medical sense or the Will versus Halleck sense.
Counsel, I want to return to footnote 1 of the GEO group case you mentioned. Do you have any examples where the defense is a non-merits defense, a non-immunity defense, but yet still has weighty public interests that justify an immediate appeal?
I'm sorry, could you ask that one more time? Non-merits defense?
Right. So footnote 1 says if it's a merits defense, you can't take up an immediate appeal.
Yes.
If it's an immunity, like a true immunity, i.e. qualified immunity, if that immunity is denied, then you can take an immediate appeal. GEO group, as you talked about, addresses this third category where the defense is neither neither a merits-based defense nor an immunity-based defense. So here we've got a jurisdictional defense, not really an immunity. We can still take an immediate appeal, or parties can take an immediate appeal, and we can entertain such an immediate appeal if such a defense raises weighty public objectives. So I'm asking you if you have an example where courts have taken a non-merits, non-immunity defense for an immediate appeal.
Circumstances where courts have taken a non-merits defense that's not an immunity, but still have taken an immediate appeal?
Yeah.
I don't have an example of that because I think that would fail Will versus Halleck's test of immediate appealability. If you're asking for an example of the type of order contemplated by footnote 1 of GEO group versus Menocal that cannot be immediately
or that appealed, that serves a sufficiently weighty public objective. Here you're arguing that
this doesn't, right?
I'm asking you, are there examples?
There are examples. The Ferris Doctrine would be one of them because it embodies the weighty public objective that would be destroyed by the litigation process itself, namely congressionally unauthorized intrusion into sensitive military affairs. Another example would be qualified immunity, the interest in preserving the initiative of government officials to act resolutely in the face of law that's not clearly established. Another example would be 11th Amendment immunity, in the interest in protecting sovereign dignity, foreign entities, foreign sovereign entities being subject to suit in another court. Presidential absolute immunity is another example of a...
But I mean, I guess to Judge Tong's point, footnote one of GEO Group seems to contemplate non-immunity type claims.
Right.
And you listed three immunity type claims. Is the Ferris Doctrine a non-merits-based non-immunity type claim?
Ferris Doctrine per established precedent is a non-merits-based immunity from suit in the category contemplated by GEO Group versus Menocal that is immediately appealable. I'm saying that the False Claims Act is not analogous to Ferris at all, in that Ferris protects only against congressionally unauthorized intrusions into intramilitary affairs, where in the context of the False Claims Act, 3730E1 expressly contemplates that there will be a litigation into intramilitary affairs as long as the relator is not a member of the armed forces. That's what puts this case into the category contemplated by footnote one of GEO Group versus Menocal, along other non-merits-based non-immunities, like the Federal Tort Claims Act's judgment bar in Will versus Halleck, or the public disclosure bar in Fiorice versus Colorado Technical University. Those are the two that I can think of off the top of my head that are non-merits-based non-immunities. Actually, now that I think of it, the entire category of 3730E relator qualification defenses probably fit that third category under GEO Group versus Menocal of non-merits-based non-immunities, in that they don't immunize a particular defendant from suit, but rather screen which types of relators can bring identical litigation against particular defendants. In the context of 3730E1, it would be members of the armed forces. In the context of 3730E2, it would be members of Congress or the judiciary. In the context of 3730E3, it would be, you know, relators who bring cases based on proceedings to which the government has already been a party, in which the defendant's already being sued by the government, or the public disclosure bar, where the relator brings, lawsuits based on publicly disclosed information. You know, a relator that brings a lawsuit based on publicly disclosed information can't bring the lawsuit, whereas the relator who is an original source can bring the lawsuit. So for all of those reasons, I think 3730E denials, including 3730E4 denials as contemplated by Fiorice, or 3730E1 denials as contemplated by this case, are non-merits-based non-immunities under GEO Group versus Menocal and are not immediately appealable under Cohen's third prong. I would address the merits, but I think they're very simple. The Uniform Code of Military Justice codifies that civilian employees are not members of the armed forces under the False Claims Act, or under Title 10, and Vermont Agency in the Supreme Court instructs us that the meaning of member of the armed forces comes from Title 10 of the United States Code. And I'll just close with 10 USC 802B, which specifies that civilians become members of the armed forces upon taking an oath of enlistment under 10 USC 502. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Rebuttal. You decided to do rebuttal? Did you decide to do rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. Just one point, Your Honor.
All right.
So, or 2 points, Your Honor. One, notwithstanding everything that my opponent said here, for the purposes of establishing jurisdiction, Your Honor, I just wanted to invite the court's attention to the fact that here, the facts show that actual disruption would occur based on the allegations. Those are the facts that are pertinent. They're all established for purposes of this particular proceeding, and those establishes that a disciplinary proceeding was instituted. So, if this suit is allowed to go through against Mr. Byrne, it in fact will intrude into military affairs, Your Honor. So I just It will, in fact, intrude into military affairs because, in fact, a disciplinary proceeding was conducted.
But that has nothing to do with the QTAM action, does it? The discipline?
Well, if in terms of jurisdiction, Your Honor, to the extent that we're talking about.
But I mean, those are two unrelated proceedings. A disciplinary action is not predicated on the QTAM, and the QTAM is not predicated on the disciplinary action. Am I correct?
Well, I think the QTAM would help to make sure that the disciplinary action is not harmful or is not intruded on by the
But aren't those two different proceedings, though?
Well, the investigation arose out of the claims that were alleged under the KETA, by the KETA Act. So I'm not really sure where you are. I don't understand the question.
I just don't see those as being the same proceeding. They're separate proceedings. The KETAM is in court. The disciplinary action is administrative in whatever agency he's working with.
Well, I'm just trying to address whether or not there are grounds for jurisdiction. And so whether I'm addressing the appealability component of it based on what was argued before me. But I'll rest on that. And the last point I want to make, I just want to clarify that I just want to make sure the panel understands that we are not seeking to have Mr. Burton dismissed under the interim military immunity provision of the FCA. We are seeking to have him dismissed, if your honors would employ your discretion to entertain the argument, under an extension of the Fairness Doctrine.
So, counsel, are you abandoning on appeal your argument that there is an immediate appeal under Section 3730E1?
No.
Okay.
No. Well, no, but so the appeal with respect to fair, I mean, with respect to the claims under the immunity provisions under the FCA, we are maintaining that appellate basis to make sure that if we are sent below, that the court confirms that we are not, my client is not prejudiced from pursuing relief under the same statute based on facts and admitted evidence, as opposed to results and conclusions that are grounded in just the unestablished allegations of the complaint.
Did your colleague want to say something in 1 minute and 46 seconds?
Thank you. My apologies. We had a death in the family a couple days ago, and I was trying to listen to a voicemail, so I'm sorry for being late. I just want to mention there are some Supreme Court cases that talk about, you know, the importance of civilian employees and the role they may play in military affairs.
Absolutely. There's no question about that.
And also, I believe it's the Stauber versus Klein case. The other thing I'd say is the fact that the Fourth Amended complaint, which was not the complaint we filed our motion to dismiss to, that was the First Amended operative complaint. It was the Fourth Amended complaint that we were brought back in on. That's the one that has the allegations about the investigation by Lieutenant General Thompson. And so that's one of the reasons that complaint heavily implicates disciplinary functions of the military.
But military officers supervise civilians all the time. That doesn't make them members of the military simply because they're being supervised by members of the military.
I think every case is different, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. There could be all kinds of different facts. You could have, for example, say a civilian employee in the government accounting office who's helping perpetrate a fraud on the government by a military contractor. But Mr. Burton's in his own specific position. As part of that, he's a high-ranking civilian official, deputy chief information officer, and there was an investigation into what he did that is exactly the subject of their complaint. Tellingly, there's no discussion in the Fourth Amendment complaint about what the outcome was of that investigation.
Does it matter?
We think so, because the fact it's not mentioned is because when the facts come out, we believe that the investigation will indicate that the government found that no further action was required. And so the plaintiffs were asking you to second guess the military's disciplinary investigation. And the cases say you can't do that.
But oftentimes agencies will not divulge the outcome due to privacy concerns. So that's not necessarily indicative of anything one way or the other.
Well, I think my point is the fact that it's not talked about, tellingly is not talked about, begs the question, what was the outcome? And what I'm saying is that based on the Fourth Amendment complaint, the plaintiffs are asking the court to second guess the military disciplinary decision-making process.
That still doesn't make him a member of the military, though. That's the problem.
Well, it may not, Your Honor, technically, but at the end of the day, as my colleague pointed out, both of them intrude into the affairs of the military and specifically into the disciplinary realm, which is critical.
Thank you. We understand your argument.
Thank you.
Thank you to all counsel for your helpful arguments. The case just argued is submitted for decision by the court. That completes our calendar for the morning. We are in recess until 9:30 a.m. tomorrow morning.
All rise.